coming to terms with a future he thought didn't exist. Was she a part of that equation? Would he forever be haunted by visions of his wife and daughter, taken from him by a consortium of politicians, military officers, and private sector financiers? Or was Reese learning to live with their memory, his life a positive testament to their legacy? Katie's eyes focused on a drop of rain as it hit the glass and trickled down the pane, weaving its way among its relatives, all born of the same gray clouds. Thinking back to Reese's surgery, she felt a tinge of guilt for what she'd done afterwards, but before she could surrender to her feelings, she had needed to know the truth.
"Can I see him now?"
Katie asked the doctor. It had not been lost on the reporter that establishing a relationship with Reese's female surgeon might allow her access not normally granted to non-family members. She had made sure the doctors had seen her with Reese on each of his visits for updated MRIs, CT scans, X-rays, and pre-op procedures. Looking the part of the devoted girlfriend was intentional. She needed answers.
"He's just coming back out from under anesthesia. He'll be a bit groggy, but I know he can have visitors now."
It didn't hurt that Dr. Rosen was a big fan of Katie's book. The surgeon had seen enough soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines come through Bethesda over the years to feel a kinship with them and know how they felt about Benghazi. Katie Baranek's debut non-fiction account, aptly titled The Benghazi Betrayal, pulled back the curtain on what had happened in the lead-up to the 13 hours when a small group of CIA contractors fought for their lives, while politicians half a world away, in no danger of being overrun, could hardly be bothered to respond to requests for reinforcements. The surgeon would not forget one of the SEALs who was killed that day. He was a corpsman she'd had the pleasure of getting to know in this very hospital when he was recovering from wounds sustained in Afghanistan before joining the agency. Katie would get special treatment.
"How did it go?"
the young reporter asked.
"All things considered, I am extremely optimistic. Brain surgery of this type has evolved exponentially in recent years. We had an option to actually do this with a local anesthesia, though we usually do those for tumors situated close to the section of the brain that controls speech. In this case, due to the size and location, we opted for general anesthesia, so he's been out for close to 4 hours now. Any side effects we need to worry about?"
Katie asked, deliberately using "we."
"Well, he might not like his new haircut. We had to shave his head to remove a flap of bone to give us access to the brain to remove the meningioma. Everything is back in place. We'll keep him here tonight, maybe tomorrow, depending on how he does, but he can start light exercise in about 3 weeks and ramp it up to his normal regimen in about 6. Thank you for taking such good care of him."
"It's our pleasure, Katie.
I'd love to be there for him when he wakes up."
"He's just down the hall. I'll be in to check on him shortly."
Katie slipped her laptop back into a bag and made her way down to the recovery room. She shot a smile at the anesthesiologist as she entered.
"Hey, Dr. Port, how's our SEAL doing?"
"Just bringing him back now, Katie."
Dr. Port was a Katie fan as well. In his off time, he volunteered with the Maryland State Police SWAT team as a medic, so he was well acquainted with the community of law enforcement tactical response units, often made up of military veterans. He was there to ensure nothing went wrong with his newest patient, who had become something of a legend in the small fraternity of special operations.
"He'll be dazed for a few minutes as the anesthesia wears off, but we'll be back to his old self in no time. You're welcome to hang out here as long as you'd like. A nurse will be checking periodically, and Dr. Rosen will be in soon to evaluate. I'm sure they told you we will be keeping him overnight for observation, but from what I understand, the surgery was extremely successful."
"Thank you, Doctor,"
Katie said, touching her hand to her heart.
"This is what we do, Katie. Dr. Rosen is one of the best in the world. Reese here was in good hands. I'll be back in a few."
Alone in the room, Katie looked down at the man who had saved her life more than a year ago. Bound and gagged, she remembered being forced to kneel on the floor of the Fisher's Island mansion with strands of explosive debt cord wrapped tightly around her neck. A CIA assassin in the employ of the federal government had pressed the button on a remote detonator connected to the explosive flexible cord. If his finger came off the button, she was dead. She was an insurance policy to ensure Reese did the right thing that night. She was in the room with him now to find out if he had. Young for what she had accomplished thus far as a journalist, her series of stories on the Benghazi fiasco and the resulting bestseller opened doors and established her as an investigative journalist who would follow the truth, regardless of where it led. That is what she was after today. Truth.
Who was James Reese? She wondered.
Was he a domestic terrorist, as the government had proclaimed when they were desperately trying to find and kill him? A vigilante hell-bent on avenging his murdered wife, daughter, and unborn son? Was he a disgruntled veteran who brought the wars to the home front after the ambush of his SEAL team in the mountains of Afghanistan? Was he her savior? Or would he have blown her head off to avenge his family? Was nothing sacred in that quest, including her? Looking up and down the hall outside his room, she softly closed the door. Taking a seat next to his bed, she took his hand in hers, thumbs gently stroking either side of the IV embedded in his vein. She thought back to that rainy night off the coast of Connecticut. She had been in a state of shock, her face bruised and bloodied, as Reese loaded her aboard a Pilatus aircraft that was to be their extract. She moved up the steps in a daze, her body exhausted, as the adrenaline that had sustained her through the violence of the previous hours subsided. Her mind barely discerned the voices. They sounded muffled, as if she were submerged in water with someone shouting at her from above. It had somehow registered that Reese was not coming with them. As Reese stepped back to close the door, Katie had turned sharply in her seat and snapped out of her trance.
Reese, how did you know Ben didn't have that detonator connected? How did you know he wouldn't blow my head off?
Reese had paused, looked Katie in the eye, and over the sound of the wind, the propeller, and the rain, replied, I didn't, before shutting the door and moving off at a run toward the marina. I didn't. Those words had haunted Katie ever since. She had masked her uncertainty since their reunion, waiting for the right time to conduct this interview. Her father had taught her that trust is the foundation of any relationship. He'd been a spy whose family was extracted from what was then Czechoslovakia by Reese's father. She knew Tom Reese had defied orders to bring them out, and that if he hadn't, her father would have been executed, and she would never have been born. Escaping to the United States in the 1980s, Katie's father had been, and still was, a big Ronald Reagan fan. Trust but verify, he had told his children. Katie intended to verify. Reese stirred. His eyes flittered once, twice, and then opened to take in the vision that was Katie Buranek.
Hey, sailor,
she joked, knowing that even though Reese had spent his entire adult life in the Navy, he would never consider himself a sailor. These days, the Navy plowed through the world's oceans on computer chips powered by nuclear reactors. Wind and sails were of a bygone era.
Katie, you didn't have to wait.
His voice was raspy from the breathing tubes that had kept him alive during the almost 4-hour surgery.
But I'm glad you did,
he added with a smile.
Well, the anesthesiologist is kind of cute, so...
Now was the moment of truth. Having a father who had passed medical information to the Americans on top Czech party officials in the name of freedom meant she was well-versed in the worlds of medicine and espionage. Katie had listened and learned. Witnessing the Warsaw Pact's response to the Prague Spring in 1968, a young Dr. Buranek decided he did not want his family to live as he had under the iron fist of Soviet bloc repression. The winds of change had started to blow. His position as a physician and surgeon for the party elite gave him access to medical records and sometimes put him in a position to ask certain questions after a surgery as his patients emerged from the fog of general anesthesia. The post-anesthesia phase, when they were uninhibited, was the time to elicit key pieces of information of interest to the CIA. Party officials were always guarded during medical procedures, but per human nature, the thugs in dark suits would occasionally slip up and turn away to flirt with a nurse, sneak a cigarette, or go to the bathroom. That was when Katie's father would work in a question passed to him by the Central Intelligence Agency. Reese was in that same phase of the post-op drug sequence, though since the introduction of Versed fentanyl in 1990, the effects were even more dramatic. Sometimes called truth serum, Versed fentanyl was used for pain control and sedation in post-op, a time when Reese would be most vulnerable and susceptible to questioning. Fentanyl was an opioid painkiller, while the Versed was an amnesiac sedative that left a target ripe for an exploitation they would never remember. A controlled amnesia. Of course, Katie could have just asked Reese over a dinner in Georgetown, but then she remembered his eyes that night on Fisher's Island as he fired four rounds into Ben Edwards' face. They were ice cold. No remorse. She needed to know with absolute certainty, and the truth serum provided her the opportunity she needed. Katie knew the clock was ticking. With every second that went by, the effects of the drugs would lessen. It was now or never. "Reese?" Katie inquired as naturally as possible, as if she were asking where he wanted to go for lunch.
"When we were on Fisher's Island, I asked you how you knew Ben didn't have the detonator connected to the explosives around my neck. Do you remember that?"
Reese's smile faded. He closed his eyes and nodded his head.
"Stay with me, Reese," she continued in her most soothing voice, continuing to stroke his hand. "Did you know it wasn't connected?"
Reese's eyes stayed closed, and Katie was worried he had drifted off.
"Damn it, this is my only chance." "Reese, did you think it was connected?" Katie pressed.
"I knew," Reese said, opening his eyes to look into hers before closing them again.
Shit, rookie move. Which question was he answering? Did he know or not?
Katie's head snapped toward the door at the sound of approaching voices.
Shit.
They'd be at the room any moment. She had to know. She just needed a few more seconds. Spinning in her chair, she looked for a way to lock the door.
"Nothing. Are you kidding me?"
Frantically, she scanned the room. She had been with her father in enough hospitals to know that, as high-occupancy facilities, the doors were all required to be auto-closing. However, the fire code and the practical necessities of efficiently running a hospital were often at odds. In violation of the fire code, auto-closing doors had to be kept manually open so doctors and nurses could move up and down the halls checking on patients. Seeing a rubber doorstop, she grabbed it and shoved it under the door, kicking it securely in place before once again taking up her position at Reese's bedside.
"You knew what, Reese?"
she asked, switching back to a calm, inquisitive tone. Reese murmured something almost inaudible.
"What?"
she asked, leaning in closer.
"I knew it wasn't connected."
Katie's body visibly trembled. All the months of pent-up wonder and doubt were answered through the side effects of narcotically-induced slumber. She heard a hand shaking the doorknob, followed by the concerned voice of the nurse.
"Excuse me! Excuse me!"
she heard from the hallway.
"Just a few more questions, damn it! Reese, how did you know?"
"Nothing."
"How did you know, Reese?"
Katie pressed on, now hearing another set of hands rapping urgently on the doorframe, and knowing she had only a scant few moments before Reese emerged from his haze. In a whisper, Reese answered through the drugs.
"Ben was standing too close. The blasting cap, the petin, and the det cord, he was too close.
The knocks were now joined by another voice at the door. She would not get another chance, so she pressed on, ignoring what now must have been causing a scene in the hallway.
"Reese," Katie continued with a bit more urgency in her voice, "why did you say that night on Fisher's that you didn't know? Why did you make me think that all these months?"
Still in the land between dreams and reality, the verse said fentanyl lowering inhibitions to a level where, no matter the answer, all would be right with the world, Reese responded truthfully.
"I didn't want you waiting on me, Katie. I was going to die that night, and I didn't want you to feel loss the way I had."
Katie gulped, her eyes misting over, suddenly aware of a tightening in her chest. Suddenly aware again of the banging outside, she rose and gracefully crossed the room, opening the door to the concerned faces of Dr. Rosen, Dr. Port, the nurse, and a security guard.
"I am so sorry. We just needed some privacy." "Ms. Baranek, you can't block the door to the room," a clearly agitated Dr. Rosen lectured,
as she and Dr. Port moved to Reese's side to check the monitors attached via wires and tubes to his body. Putting on her most demure and apologetic smile, Katie lowered her head.
"I really do apologize. I just did not want a special moment interrupted."
"It's okay, Doc,"
Reese said groggily, struggling to push himself up to his elbows.
"We had to discuss something here in the skiff."
Dr. Rosen's demeanor softened.
"Well, don't do that again, Frogman, or I'll have you keel-hauled."
"Aye, aye, Doc,"
Reese smiled, attempting to raise his hand in salute, but only managing to lift it a few inches off the bed.
"It's okay,"
Dr. Rosen assured the security guard, who didn't know quite what to do in the presence of the cable news personality and the man whose face had been plastered on televisions and newspapers across the country just over a year ago.
"I'll take it from here."
"Yes, ma'am," he replied, walking back into the hall.
"You just rest up, Commander,"
the doctor said, switching into military mode.
"Katie, you can stay here with him if you'd like. Just promise me you will not bar the door again, no matter what powers of persuasion he attempts to exert." "I'll be on my guard."
As Dr. Port injected a microdose of narcotic into Reese's IV to assist with the transition out of his dream state, Dr. Rosen turned to Katie.
"He'll be up and walking around in a few hours, if you can believe that. He's going to be fine." "Thank you, doctor."
Moving toward the hallway with Dr. Port, the surgeon stopped and turned back toward Katie, who had again taken up residence at Reese's side.
"I hope you got the answer you were looking for, Miss Baranek."
Not taking her eyes off the frogman who had appeared to drift back to sleep, Katie replied,
"I did."
Alone again in the recovery room, Katie wondered if Reese remembered her questions. If so, she knew that memory would soon dissolve, along with the remaining mixture of Versed fentanyl.
"Rest up, James. I'll be here when you wake up."
Chapter 7. SVR Headquarters, Moscow. Alexander Zharkov wasn't sure what his father was up to, but as the deputy director of Directorate S in the nation's Foreign Intelligence Service, his ability to assist him was substantial. That was the entire reason he held the post, to be the eyes and ears of the Bratva. Directorate S was responsible for the illegal intelligence operations of the former KGB, deploying strategic long-term deep cover operatives into foreign countries. They were more commonly referred to as sleeper agents. He commanded the nation's most effective assassins. Alexander knew that citizens of the West were getting soft. Most of them believed the Red threat had ended with the collapse of the Soviet Union and that Russian spies were now only found in 80s movies. The truth was that the SVR had more sleeper agents embedded throughout the United States and Europe than they ever had during the Cold War. The open borders of the European Union and America's current obsession with terrorism left them vulnerable for penetration. They remained